On healthcare access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2348.
You want to call Joel O'Leary from the governor's office.
Okay, do we have a list?
I am. I'm giving it right now.
Joel, you want to start? Damn right. Right, don't think I'm not counting. Joe, please go ahead.
Chair Greenlee, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. My name for the record is Joe O'Leary. I'm Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Policy Advisor. It's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon, and I want to thank the chair for giving this bill a hearing. This bill is one of Governor Kulongoski's priority public safety bills, yet here I am at the subcommittee with respect to health and health care issues, and I want to explain to you first and foremost why this bill relates to public safety. According to the Oregon Department of Corrections, approximately 75% of the offenders in their custody right now, that's 75% of the inmates at DOC, suffer from severe to moderate alcohol or substance abuse addiction. There are similar numbers that reflect 85, in some cases up to 75% of addicted offenders in county jails and state prisons throughout the country. I think if you ask any law enforcement official, they will tell you that substance abuse is at the heart of much, if not a very significant amount of crime in our state. This bill is presented to you as an opportunity to remove an unnecessary barrier to substance abuse treatment that exists in Oregon law. This bill, one might say it's the best kind of bill. It's the bill that repeals a statute rather than creating a new statute. This would repeal the bill, the law known as the Uniform Accident and Sickness Policy Provision Law. This is an obsolete statute. It's a statute that prevents doctors from being reimbursed for treatment of injuries that are related to alcohol and drug abuse. It discourages doctors from counseling addicted or drug abusing patients or referring them to treatment. And finally, it skews data that healthcare professionals collect about the scope of substance abuse in our state. There are several other folks here, or hopefully arriving here soon, from the Governor's Meth Task Force and from the Oregon Medical Association's Meth Task Force, from whom this concept originated. And I know that there are folks from the OMA who have suggestions to make this bill even stronger, and I look forward to their comments and to your discussion of their comments as well.
Joe, before we ask for questions, could you describe what the UPPL is?
Mr. Chair,
being repealed, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the statute exists. It's Oregon Revised Statute 743.480. I promised the chair I would look up that acronym, and I've got it for you. It's the Uniform Accident and Sickness Policy Provision Law. The best that I can determine, this was part based on the material that's been provided to me, some of which is going to be furnished to you by some of the other speakers. This was a concept that was offered as a uniform statute in state legislatures across the country back in the 40s and 50s. And the policy behind it, from what I have been told and learned, was that if an individual was had an injury that was caused by their own substance abuse, alcohol abuse, or drug abuse, the insurer ought to be able to disallow payment for that injury. And again, this is from reading that I have done, and there's some documents that some of the witnesses are going to provide to you in today's hearing. But to my mind, this appears to stem from an outmoded view of substance abuse that was apparently prevalent in the 40s and 50s, but to my mind, has not stood the test of time. And the opportunity I think you have here in repealing the statute is to make a policy shift that acknowledges that substance abuse and alcohol abuse is something that should be addressed, that should be freely and openly discussed between doctor and patient. Data about this issue should be compiled and should be gathered so policymakers such as yourself are able to make informed decisions about substance abuse issues and their crossover with public safety.
Thank you very, very much. Are there questions, Mr. O'Leary?
I have a question.
Please.
Chair. Mr. O'Leary, can you tell us about the financial consequences? I'm sure that they've been reviewed as well.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Richardson, my understanding of the financial consequences, and I'm going to let some other folks who are, I think, more studied in this than I, is that it is going to be limited. Here's what I've been told by some of the doctors, some of the members of the OMA who brought this issue to the governor's meth task force and to the attention of the governor. The reality is that because this statute is here, doctors still will treat patients that come to them with these issues that are the result of substance abuse, alcohol, or drug abuse. But what they will do is code very carefully what they're doing so that they are sure to get reimbursed. This is, a very well-intentioned circumvention, though, of the statute. And it just speaks to why the statute really has no place any longer in Oregon law. The financial issue goes, that is the financial issue, too. These are things that are being reimbursed for now. They're just being called something different. And what we are doing, or we are asking you to do with this repeal, is give medical professionals the ability to call these things what they are and be reimbursed for them.
Excuse me? Yes. The insurance industry will be testifying, and they are not opposed to this. They have an amendment that they want to talk about. That's my understanding. Any other questions of Mr. O'Leary? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for starting the process along. I think we have lots of time, so I don't mind going out of order. Joel Ariel, do you want to talk about this for me?
Chair, I was here more to be able to answer questions at the end and help clarify issues if there are.
Okay, good, good. Then we'll, you keep a note of the issues. Rob Bavette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm here wearing my hat as president of the Oregon Alliance for Drug Endangered Children and a member of the Governor's Meth Task Force. Both organizations unanimously endorsed this bill for the exact reasons that Mr. O'Leary has testified to just a moment ago. It's an antiquated statute that creates an absurd result as a practical matter, with doctors essentially certifying different pieces of information that essentially preclude us from collecting accurate data on addictions in Oregon. We need to correct the statute. You're going to be hearing in a moment from the Oregon Medical Association that would like not only to repeal the statute, but to actually flip it on its head and say insurance companies shouldn't be discounting or not covering these activities because of addiction issues. I think this goes in line with the parity bill you passed last session. This is an old statute in need of fixing. It's been in need of fixing for a long time. Happy to answer any questions. We not only support the bill itself, but the amendments proposed by the OMA. I have not seen the amendments proposed by the industry. Happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Well, that was short and sweet. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Sharon Kelly? Sharon's been talking to me about this bill for some time. I'm glad we're actually talking about it on the record, Sharon.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Sharon Kelly, and I'm on the Governor's Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, and my chief responsibility this last year and next year will be discrimination. I'd like to introduce Hannah Euler, who's in the back of the room, who's chair of the Governor's Council.
Is she going to join you?
Would you like to join me? Oh, there you are.
Land, this is a fun experience, right?
Yes. The Governor's Council actually worked on the repeal of the UPPL law, which is the repeal of the Uniform Individual Accident and Sickness Policy Provision Law, about 6 months ago, and we have an LC 1356 before we knew that the Governor's office was also supported. So we'll probably collapse that law because we want to be coordinated in this effort. In 2006, the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs passed a resolution called Ending Discrimination. This resolution was based upon recommendations from the American Bar Association and a national policy board called Join Together. At the top of the list of the resolution was the repeal of the UPPL law, and here's why. The UPPL was promulgated as a model law in 1947 when treatment for alcohol problems was generally not available and regional trauma and emergency centers did not exist. There are over 40 studies evaluating the use of brief interventions in healthcare settings, including ERs and trauma centers, that document effectiveness in reducing subsequent alcohol intake, DUIs, alcohol-related traffic infractions, alcohol-related arrests, and injury-related hospital readmissions. Cost-benefit analysis conducted at the University of Washington. I want to stop here for a minute to tell you that the state of Washington repealed the UPPL law in their last legislative session. Anyway, University of Washington demonstrate that ER screening and intervention will result in an estimated three-year net national savings of $1.82 billion in direct medical costs, which are estimated to be 15% of total costs, with the remainder due to property damage, and that $4 will be saved for every dollar invested in this kind of intervention. After being treated for a serious injury resulting from substance abuse, most patients are in an ideal state of mind for counseling. Currently, fewer than 15% of injured patients treated in ERs are screened for alcohol use and referred for counseling. And you could infer from that perhaps 85% are not, that they're actually paid for by their insurance companies. We don't have any really good data of that. Perhaps information might be coming from the state of Washington that might tell us what the insurance companies are paying new, but the likelihood is pretty great that they're already covering these incidents anyway because of the reluctance of the reporting. Finally, addiction to alcohol and other drugs is a treatable chronic disease that should be viewed and addressed as a public health issue. While alcohol or other drug use begins voluntarily, years of research have shown that continued use causes biological, psychological, and behavioral changes. For some people, these changes compromise their ability to stop. Effective care can produce control of this chronic disease. The UPPL law eliminates a valuable teaching moment, which is why this is an issue not only of medical consequences, but it's also a discriminating issue. What we're doing is we're saying that you don't have a disease, and so as a consequence, we're not paying for the injury resulting from the disease, and we're losing the ability to diagnose and treat what is actually a treatable disease. I handed you out the information that I gleaned in the kind of points that I felt were valuable for you to make a decision. The Washington State Public Health Association, the General Surgery News, and the Surgery News. I hope this is helpful.
Thank you, Ann. You have a comment?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and other committee members. I'm Ann Uhler. I'm the chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. The only update I can tell you that I just recently read about the Washington study is that some of their hospitals are showing more than 50% of folks coming in the ER have an alcohol and drug problem. So this, you know, is significant and will save the state, both in safety net costs and in health care costs, a significant amount of money.
Thanks. Everybody claimed I had too much beer at the Blazer game. I deny it. Are there any questions of Ms. Kelly?
Good question. When you talk about all this money being saved, where's the money going to come from that it's going to be saved from? I mean, they're still going to get paid, so who's going to be paying
it? Recidivism. What happens now, because we're not identifying the disease and referring and treating, what happens is, for instance, in DUIs, you know, we constantly wonder why people are repeating. It's because they're not diagnosed or treated. So much of this information is not just from property damage, but from repeated consequences of use of alcohol. So what we're doing is we're intervening, and that's what we're trying to say. If we had this opportunity to intervene, diagnose, and refer to treatment all these people who clearly have problems, then we would be preventing the reoccurrence of some of these issues.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Is the assumption then that all the treatment that they would get will be of the same benefit? In other words, making the referral is only going to be valuable if the treatment that's given is effective. And so is all of the treatment that they receive effective?
I'm going to give that question to Ann, who's an absolute expert.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and Representative Richardson. That's the data that we have about the savings comes from what they've shown when you do a brief intervention in emergency, is that they are less apt to come back. That's the recidivism issue over and over and over again. So the big savings is in emergency because you're having fewer, which then relates to keeping the cost of health care down. And so there's that savings. In answer to your question about the effectiveness is, it's real clear that treatment is effective as other chronic illnesses like diabetes, like health, heart-associated illness, and we feel quite proud of that. It's, of course, it's a chronic relapsing disease, so it may be just like diabetes. It doesn't mean that everybody suddenly does everything right over the period of their illness, and that's also true in any in other chronic illnesses like addiction.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Greenberg. I think I just understood it, and I want to confirm that I'm right. So currently, insurers are able to deny claims for accidents that are the result of alcohol or drugs.
Correct.
And in practice, what happens is that the accident occurs, the victim goes to the ER, to a trauma center, or elsewhere, and the alcoholism isn't reported to the insurer in order to receive reimbursement. As a consequence, the person doesn't get the counseling or treatment that's needed to treat the underlying cause, which is the alcohol or drug addiction. And so they go back to the ER the next time. Another accident occurs, they go back to the ER. Same cycle continues. Am I correct in that understanding?
That's perfect. That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
That's all I need.
And if I may, Mr. Oreo, if you'll keep one of the questions in note. It's my impression that most insurance companies aren't trying to enforce this anymore anyway. You just have the distortion on one side, but you can answer
only
that.
Only an issue in the individual market.
No, wait till you come.
Let me say one other thing. That, as a member of the Meth Task Force last year, when we tried to gather data about how many people were hurt as a result of meth labs, we could not collect that data for this very reason, is that when we called the hospitals to find out, they said they can't record it because it's related to a drug. Mm-hmm. So we had no idea how many people, this is in the burn centers, so we couldn't collect any of that data. So it's another stumbling block we have with this law.
You now all have a copy of the statute, and it only relates to health insurance. Vice Chair Richards just asked that question. Are you all done?
I am. Thank you, Chair.
All right, Senator Moore?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm looking at the surgery news, the handouts, and this came from you. And it says that nearly 25% of trauma surgeons reported they've been denied payment by an insurer in the last 6 months, et cetera. So I'm assuming that the trauma surgeons are treating the patient. And later in the article, it says, in general, trauma surgeons were not familiar with the UPPL. And so they're treating it. They code it. They give it a ICD-9, CPT code, ICD-9 that says it's drug-related, essentially, and then they're being denied payment. So it's not the treatment in the ER that's really an issue. It's the follow-on care. Is that correct?
It's two things. It's one is if a doctor recognizes it as an alcohol and addiction problem, there's a brief intervention that they can then do at that time so that somebody then gets referred. Right now, there's no referral, and there's no brief intervention.
I bet they don't code it twice that way.
As an expert, you sound like an expert. So as a practical measure, let's just say you're in an automobile accident and alcohol was involved. And let's just say it was less serious than some are, and you broke an arm and a leg. The surgeon would treat you. And the way the state of Oregon is now, if there was alcohol involved, the insurance company wouldn't pay the surgeon for the repair of the arm and the leg. He could do that. The hospitals have a tendency, according to the data that we have, although it's, as Ann pointed out, it's less than we'd like it to be. So what happens generally is the hospitals just simply don't report that there was alcohol involved. So that the surgeon can be paid, because a lot of people who go in are not capable by themselves to bear the financial burden of that ER visit by themselves. So on their own resources, their financial resources. So that's generally what happens. And this is why I referred to the 15%, which is garnered actually from the state of Washington. And then in that document, it talks about 25%. So the bottom line is that we're really not sure. We can't count document. We don't count.
Okay. Follow on, Mr. Chair.
Please.
One last one. And so along with this, and I have to agree with Mr. O'Leary that this is the best kind, it removes something instead of adds to it, but that there's a significant education piece that's going to have to follow on, because if the surgeons aren't familiar with the UPPL today, then the hospitals and everybody needs to have a tale about how this is going to impact and what they need to do.
They will. You're right. That is true.
Representative Minnis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Sharon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have a question for you. You've alluded to an accident and someone goes to the emergency room, and you've indicated that they would be diagnosed as an alcoholic. How would an ER doctor be able to diagnose someone that's come in with an injury as an alcoholic with one visit in the ER? I mean, you've said that, so I just wanted to clarify.
How that would happen.
How would they diagnose someone who may have been drinking as an alcoholic if all they do is see them in the emergency room?
Suzanne was a professional with CODA. She ran that agency. She could probably answer that question.
That'd be
but
fine.
In one of the documents that I passed out, they really talk about this new program that would have to be developed within hospitals. So.
It's the brief intervention the assessment and the brief intervention that we're talking about that would need to happen for the person. Most hospitals, that's done by the social worker. At least when I've sat in emergency, I've heard of social workers then come in and talk to the person. But a doctor can also do it. We also have this odd piece in our state policy is that currently health plan individuals are not denied payment. Doctors are not denied payment under our health plan. So that's why I think we're getting a mixed reaction about some doctors know about it and some doctors don't. So what this another reason to do this is that the policy will be the same for everybody coming in the door. The Medicaid and Medicare, as of January 1st, passed an administrative rule that said now Medicare and Medicaid, a doctor can get paid for a brief assessment and referral to treatment. So things are really coming together that will be real consistent, but we do have to train doctors and other allied health professionals about how to do the brief assessment and the referral. Some are very good about it, and some don't have those skills yet.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
What about the law enforcement community that would usually, if there's an accident and there's alcohol involved, they're intervening absolutely in most cases. How would you fold into that activity? Because oftentimes they're cited or they go to jail. How do you work with them on the referrals, or how is it currently?
Well, certainly somebody that receives a DUI will get a referral through the corrections system. One of the things that happens many times is it's not police related. I don't think a lot of people even know that. Many times it's people falling downstairs. Mm-hmm. So it's a more medical response than it is police response. Falling off a curb. I mean, it's amazing. Okay, I know.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Anyway, there's lots of other kinds of injuries that people come into the hospital that parents, spouses, loved ones bring their loved ones in. And so it's not just with DUI or with the police.
Okay, so just to be clear, so I understand, then you would develop a program, or their program would be developed to educate the doctors as to certain signs they would see that would require intervention.
Absolutely. In fact, in our effectiveness report that we're about to publish, it's our first recommendation is that some kind of training program be developed in the state for brief intervention and assessment for doctors because of this. It needs to start in the training schools, you know, and we need to do it in a lot of different ways, and our plan is to help move that forward. I have participated in that in the state of Minnesota. I helped to do some training of doctors, and so there's already some good curriculum out there, so I think we can do it.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And what?
You'd like.
Thank you. And what is the cost to the insurance? I mean, have you been able to track a number, or do you have any idea of what kind of an impact this would be across the spectrum for not only folks that are buying insurance right now at the private level, as well as, you know, how would that impact costs, if at all?
Well, it actually overall will reduce the cost because of this recidivism rate. And, in fact, that's what the studies show very clearly, is that you have a reduction in insurance costs. It's not that a person comes into ER and doesn't get any help. It's just that they don't get any intervention, so they don't keep coming back because of the same problem.
Well, that's a testimony from the insurance industry about that, Representative.
And what is the success rate for this program in other states? Do you have any?
For recovery?
Yes, or for the doctors. And you indicated this program is ongoing in other states.
Well, that's what we're saying in Washington, and why I was saying is that they're still doing the study in Washington because they just started it. But
2004 is when they passed it.
But they're already seeing a large decrease in costs.
And they haven't even finished it. Is Washington the first state to do this?
No, there's...
Six.
Okay.
Six states have repealed it.
Thank you.
Please, if you have follow-up questions, just go on and ask them.
Okay, thank you. Just a quick follow-up. I had a personal experience where my father-in-law was a severe alcoholic, but yet he had cancer, and because of no intervention, or there just wasn't a plan in place to really identify what symptoms he was displaying that were part of the cancer, which it was in, you know, neurology-based, versus his treatment, I mean, versus alcoholism. I mean, would things like this be picked up in that intervention plan? Or, I mean, because I was traumatized when I finally got him to a neurologist, and then we went through the interview and all the symptoms that he had that really were so complicated there. And I'm just hoping, that was like 20 years ago. I'm hoping those things like that don't happen anymore. But
well, I certainly hope they don't happen anymore, Representative Quam. And I think it's, you know, it depended on the skills of the physician that's mm-hmm. doing the interview, whether or not they can recognize the other co-occurring illnesses
symptoms,
going
yeah.
on. But it's certainly an issue that we're looking at across the board about integrating addiction and health care and the knowledge base, improving the knowledge base for all allied doctors and allied health professionals.
Well, I'd like to think if we would have done something symptomatic, we would have picked up the signs a lot sooner than what we did.
We agree.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Jim Lace. Welcome, Dr. Lace. See you again. That's good.
For the record, I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I also represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. And I'm here to testify in favor of the proposed legislation. Thank you for having me speak. A couple of quick questions. As far as diagnosing somebody with alcoholism, it may be hard to do just on one ER visit in answer to Representative Minnis's question. You can say that the patient is alcohol impaired at the time of the accident, but further history, further questioning will actually could reveal about the alcoholism itself. But you can just say this is clearly they were impaired at that time. You've all heard the current system, which is that if I'm in the ER, and I'm not usually in the ER, I'm a pediatrician, but if I'm in the ER doctor and somebody comes in, they've been in an MVA, broke their leg, I'm not going to code that out because they were drunk or under the effects of methamphetamine right now. Why? Because you don't get paid. I'll code out the broken leg. So we've lost that golden opportunity right there to get that patient identified with that impairment that they have, whether it's drug or alcohol. Then at that point, we can begin intervention in the emergency room and then also follow up with intervention as an outpatient. You already heard the issue about being afraid to diagnose that. There's going to be another bill that's going to come to you looking at another sin tax, the increase in the alcohol tax right now to fund drugs, mental health, and alcohol in adult population. If you look at our foster group children, somewhere between 80-95% of the kids, depends on the county, because Marion County is the highest, are there because of their parents, either using meth or having mental health issues. Alcohol is in there, too, of course. So the treatment is going to be a harder issue. In other words, you identify somebody in the emergency room and say, oh, my gosh, you know, they're on meth, and we know that they've got alcohol. If they're on OHP, where do they get the treatment? Are there a lot of programs that are available right now to them? The answer is no. That's why we're going to come back to you with another bill that's going to look for ways to fund that, and hopefully we'll get another $160 million into the system with the alcohol bill to actually provide services, because that's an extremely important part of that. But the data is so important, because if you don't code that out, and typically that doesn't get coded out in reality, then you don't have a way to track and to say how many patients are there, how many people. We can go to Marion County and tell you that 75% of the inmates are there because of meth, but we can't go to the emergency room. We can give you some rough numbers looking at other states, but because they don't get coded out, they don't get diagnosed on any kind of a data system. And that's just the plain truth. It ends up being cost-shifting. If you actually put the diagnosis in there, and then the insurance company says, nope, we're not going to pay for that because they're a criminal. I mean, they violated the law at that point. Why should we pay for somebody who's violated the law? And I understand that from an insurance standpoint. But what we're saying is, okay, that's part of it, but we also want to try to help that patient. We also want to make sure we've got information so we can plan out needs for the future. And without a repeal and a change in the existing statute, you really can't do that openly. Because it sounds like we're being undercover, we're lying, we're not doing what you would call, you know, the best thing. I guess you can answer that sort of. What we're saying is, you know, the hospital wants to get paid and the doctors want to get paid. Otherwise, it's uncompensated care and you cost shift to other programs. And so I think if we're all part of this together and we realize that it's going to be an expensive society as a whole, we can all be open about it. We're open about it. You come in, if you're having chest pain, if we think you have a heart attack, we're not going to say because you're a smoker and that's caused a heart attack that you shouldn't pay for that. That's not what happens. And we want to treat this in the same manner, which is, we're in an MVA, you fell down the stairs, whatever it was, and you're under the effect of alcohol, methamphetamine, some other controlled substance. It should be something that I prescribe for them also. Then we want to be able to deal with that openly and not have to hide that somehow from somebody's eyes and from an insurance company standpoint. That's kind of the short sweep. We put in here in my testimony an amendment that we'd like to have in it, so it's very clear which it says an insurer may not deny coverage for the treatment of an injury solely because the injury was sustained as a consequence of the insurance being intoxicated or under the influence of a controlled substance. We thought that that would clearly specify what the intent of this is.
And we have that coming our way, is that right?
I do not believe it's been submitted yet, sir. They're just bringing it to the table for discussion right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions of Dr. Lace? That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We hope you all vote yes on this. We think it's very important. And there'll be other bills that are coming out along the same thing, dealing with meth, dealing with the issue of making sure that we fund the treatment programs. I'm a pediatrician. I can tell you that 90% of the kids here in Marion County are coming to my office because of meth addiction. And if we can't get that mom treatment, and you asked about treatment protocols, you asked about how long, meth minimum is 6 months. To get somebody in there. Alcohol, you can get a lot of them in and out in a month with adequate therapy, with adequate follow-up. Meth is a completely different topic. Huge expense to us as a society. We need to be upfront with that and deal with that as a big issue. And we want to fund those adult treatment programs because we want those families to be reunited. You can't lock everybody up. You can't lock ourselves out of that whole epidemic that we're having. So,
thank you very much, Dr. Lace. Elise Brown? Might be you or somebody else with you, Elise. What's the...
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. Elise Brown representing America's Health Insurance Plans. And we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about House Bill 2348. And I know that you, Chair Greenlich, understood that the health plans were supportive of this. And I just wanted to clarify for AHIP members, we do have some that are in the disability business. And for that reason, we do have some issues with the bill. Prohibiting an exclusion is just another way of mandating coverage. So from that perspective, we are against it. Plans need to have the flexibility to design...
You're against it on the health insurance side or on the disability side?
On the health insurance side because of our members who are in the disability business. So I know that there is a...
I want to keep talking. Are you against it because of the health insurance side or because of the disability side? You're saying you're opposed to it because some of your members are in the disability business.
Right.
Are they opposed to it because of the disability side?
We're opposed to it because of the health insurance side, because it becomes another mandate. By taking away the exclusion, it becomes another mandate.
And it's not about disability.
It is about disability. I'm sorry. It is about disability, too.
I still need to push on this. Is it because of disability, too, or is it because of disability? If disability were not covered on this, would you still say your association is opposed to the bill?
It's because of disability.
Okay. Can we, as a part of this, just to, we want to hear yours, but get Mr. Harrell off. It is time now to talk about it.
Actually, if I could take a minute, I might.
Please do.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurance Companies. And we represent about 300 companies licensed in Oregon, including Standard Insurance Company of Portland and others. And the reason we have a concern about the bill is not really related to anything that's been discussed about the reimbursement of medical expenses. And I think we need to make clear, our companies don't write any coverages that reimburse medical expenses. What we write is something called disability income insurance, usually purchased by individuals as a financial protection product. So it's to protect their small business, their partnership, their family business, the breadwinner's income. We pay cash benefits to those people, and we underwrite them based on the risk that they bring to the transaction. And under current state law, we're allowed to do that in a number of ways, obviously to look at medical condition and other issues that may increase or decrease risk. Our goal, of course, is to cover as many of those voluntary applicants as we can and to give them the most preferential rate we can. We want to make sure we're assessing risk fairly and accurately. And unfortunately, even though this bill is, I think, intended to apply to health insurance only, and we usually,
that's what it says.
Yes, I know. But unfortunately, in 731.162, the term health insurance is extremely broad. And I think Mr. Ario can perhaps confirm this, that it also includes, because it is so broad, these individual disability income protection products unintentionally. So we think we've been swept in unintentionally into this bill, and that's why we have the concern. So the amendment we have that we would like to address with you would simply, that is if you decide to go ahead with the issue of medical reimbursement, would make sure that this bill applied to that and that it didn't apply to individually underwritten financial protection products. And we have drafted an amendment. Actually, it's from the newer version of the UPPL that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has drafted, and we think it would take care of our issue. Now, the reason there's some confusion is that the AHIP membership includes some of our members who write disability income insurance, but our members only write that. They don't write the health piece. So I can't speak to that issue, but maybe Joel can confirm. This definition of health insurance in Oregon is very broad, and we've done this many times, having to come in and clarify that we think we were not intended to be covered. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, maybe before we do, let's get Joel on this one so we know a little bit about what we're talking about here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Let me make two general points about the bill and then come to John's specific question. One is that the issues here are pretty narrow. The exclusion that we're talking about today only applies in the individual insurance market, not in the group insurance market. So in the group insurance market, there isn't this kind of exclusion. No carrier has filed it, and if they did file it, we would see it to be inconsistent with the mental health and alcohol and chemical abuse treatment mandate. It would be kind of odd to say you have to treat this disease, but you can also exclude injuries that are caused by this disease. So there has not been an issue in the group insurance market, and we wouldn't anticipate there being any issues before or after this bill in that market. That then, if you remember our testimony last week, means it's pretty limited, because about 90% of the health insurance market is group insurance. So we are talking about, 5% that is in the individual market to start with. And then secondly, even in that market, as the chair pointed out before, the clear trend is against this kind of exclusion. So the two largest carriers don't have this exclusion. A few carriers in our state still do have the exclusion in their policy. So this law would affect those insurers, but we're dealing with a fairly narrow range. Second point I wanted to make is in response to the OMA proposal to not simply exclude this, but go on and make it clear that it needs to be covered. And we would generally be in support of that. Depends on the language here, because there's some tricky issues in how this might play with other exclusions. But if you simply remove this from the code, then there wouldn't be anything in the code that would speak to the individual policy. And our general regulatory authority is if an exclusion is not specifically prohibited, we have to have, if the code is silent on an exclusion, we have to have some language somewhere that we can point to prohibit that kind of exclusion if it's brought to us. So it would help us, would clarify the authority if, in addition to repealing the exclusion, there was some language that indicated that we had the authority to prohibit the exclusion. Otherwise, I could expect with at least some of the carriers potentially a legal argument around that issue. As to John's specific issue, I didn't know that was the specific issue today, so I don't have a specific response, but in our definition of health insurance is broad, and if I heard him correctly, he's talking about individually underwritten disability policies being excluded from this debate. I think the issues are substantively different there, and again, I wasn't prepared to give a final answer on that, but I do think that's a much different set of questions than the ones that were brought with this bill today.
Yeah, it is clear in the definition of health insurance in that statute that they are included as health insurance, I think, and we would need to have an amendment, because I think the intention is not about that, although it is interesting. If I have a couple of drinks in an accident, I'm not an alcoholic, and I become a quad as a result of that accident, I assume under this, the disability policy could exclude payment for that.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to answer that. It is a critical point. Again, the DI policies, the disability income policy, does not pay for any medical expense or any treatment for an injury. That was the previous witness language. That's not an issue with our contracts. We don't pay for the treatment. We pay reimbursement of cash for lost income. So the issue of intoxication or the use of illegal drugs or whatever it might be is a risk issue. And a lot of our companies that sell these individual products will not include the exclusion at your request, but you'll have to pay a little bit more for it, because what you're saying is that there's a higher risk of something that we have to pay out potentially for many years. So it's a matter of assessing risk in our product line. It's a little different issue than paying for treatment of an injury.
But you are saying that if I had a couple of drinks, I had an automobile accident with a 0.02 level, you could deny the disability payment as a result of that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's the scenario at all. I think, at least as we look at the word intoxication, we would. I think our companies would look at that as legal intoxication, which is a lot different than just having a beer or two at the Blazer game, hopefully. But again, it would be if someone was actually intoxicated and driving illegally over the limit, then that certainly poses a higher risk for these income protection policies.
Mr. Chair, I would add that when we see language about intoxication in a policy, we regularly make the policy specify that that means above legal limits.
Thank you. Now, Lisa, I don't think you had a chance to finish.
Well, I have to circle back here because I did such a miserable job of trying to say what John did so well at the beginning. But again, coming to you from the standpoint of taking that exclusion away adds a price to it. And in our world, we call that a mandate. And so we are interested in the amendment that's floating around. I know John Powell talked to you about that this morning, and that's something that AHIP would be interested in supporting.
Are there other questions, this panel?
Yeah, I do have a question. So if this applies to individual plans, which is 5% of the total health insurance market, and the two largest carriers already don't have this exclusion in their policies, so what percentage of the total insurance market are we talking about affecting? So that, because I guess what circles back to is, with all these expected savings, I would assume become somewhat tenuous to support if we're talking about 0.01% of an insurance market.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, you're right on your math. It would be a very small percentage of the market that currently operate under this exclusion. But as I listened to the prior testimony, it did seem that a lot of people, which is not uncommon about insurance issues, weren't clear about those insurance requirements. And so there may be more reaction in the emergency rooms on this issue because people don't know when it is and isn't there. But it did sound like a lot of people were overreacting to the number of people who don't actually have coverage for this situation. It's a small sliver of the market.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Before you leave, I'm sorry. My assumption is we will have at least two amendments for this bill. We won't be able to hear it again until a week from today. We will schedule a week from today and plan on moving it with or without some of those amendments. And unless anybody has any other questions about this, well, I guess I really would like a clear statement from some of the major carriers as to whether there is a problem with this bill if the individual disability policies are excluded from it. I thought I had heard that was the major problem, and we'll see on Monday. So thank you very much for testifying. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill before we close this hearing? I'll close the hearing on HB 2348. We'll notice a hearing and a work session with invited only testimony a week from today in this committee. And having no other business, we'll joint meeting at 5:00 with the Senate committee. It's in the agenda, right? So it's a formal meeting. It would be nice if we had a quorum tonight, if that's possible.
And they're talking about transparency this evening.
Excellent.
And then we have a joint meeting with the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services Wednesday at 3 o'clock in this room to talk about House Bill 2216, which is the expansion of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. The Senate will have their bill also. So the dais might be a little crowded on Wednesday, and we may have a very full crowd.
Can we move to E?
We are in E on Wednesday for that meeting.
Well, not F.
They're having a Ways and Means meeting at that time. We can't use the bigger room.
We are adjourned.